when it comes to your finances, you think you've done it all. You've saved, you've researched, and you've invested all that you can. Now it's time to take those investments to the next level by using the brand behind every great investor, Yahoo Finance. As America's number one finance destination, Yahoo Finance has everything you need, whether you're a seasoned trader or just dipping your toes into the market. Join the millions of investors who trust Yahoo Finance to guide them on their financial journey. For comprehensive financial news and analysis, visit yahoofinance.com, the number one financial destination, yahoofinance.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Welcome to the Badass Women's Hour podcast. Three women, one podcast, and a whole load of badass. With me, Harriet Minter and Emma Sexton. No Natalie Campbell this week. She's having a well-deserved break. We do have some stellar guests for you, though. We're joined by Deborah James, aka Bal Babe, who talks to us about living with cancer, coping with grief, and how to celebrate your successes even in the worst of times. Plus, Titi Dawoodu talks about changing the face of theatre, and Alex O'Neill tells us what it's like to move back in with your parents when you're 35.
Underwear, armpit hair, many imitators, but no one compares.
Badass Women's Hour XL with Harriet Minter, Natalie Campbell and Emma Sexton on Talk Radio.
One, two, three, four!
And now we are very lucky to be joined by the beautiful, gorgeous and downright fabulous Deborah James, aka Bal Babe. Hello!
Hello, good evening, ladies.
Welcome, my darling. Now, we've had you on the show before, but a lot has changed since you were last here.
Yeah, I was thinking about that as I walked in, actually. I was thinking, right, last time I was on the show, I can't even remember what I was up to, but I know that the last 8 weeks for me, a lot has happened, actually.
Yeah, when you were on the show, so you were co-hosting, actually, because Harriet and Natalie had abandoned me. And
yes, we were.
I think you just got the news that you were in remission, actually.
Yeah, and then I had to have CyberKnife because, unfortunately, I wasn't in remission. I think I found out, actually, almost a week later that my cancer had returned. So I've been undergoing some CyberKnife treatment, but alongside, I've been working really closely on a podcast alongside a colleague of mine, Rachel Bland, who, sadly, I then recorded with up until 10 days before she died, which I walked in here, didn't I, and I said, you know what, I've had a rough couple of weeks, not just because of her death. I think I live in a bit of a morbid world, and I don't want to switch the conversation.
You're
in terms of like a negative conversation on a Saturday, but you know what, I currently am in a cancer world. I have stage 4 bowel cancer that I'm currently being treated for. But I live around people who, unfortunately, they were diagnosed at the same time as me. In the last couple of weeks, 5 people I knew died.
Wow, that's a lot.
It is a lot. And we're going to keep talking to Deborah about it here on Badass Women's Hour XL. We're going to be hearing all her stories. She is a total inspiration, so stick around.
The Fempire Strikes Back. Badass Women's Hour XL on Talk Radio.
We are joined here on Badass Women's Hour XL by the fabulous Deborah James. Deborah, we were saying just before the break, you are feeling in a bit of a weird place right now.
Yeah, I am. I don't think it's bad to admit that.
No.
Either.
I think it's really brave to speak so openly about it.
I think I wrote a column this week. So I write a column for The Sun every week online. And I wrote a column this week about dealing with grief. And I was really honest. I kind of said that actually grief is... You sometimes think that you're dealing with something. You know when you're a bit blindsided by an event in your life. And what you actually realise is actually you just deal with it by going a bit numb and carrying on. You know when kind of, you know, you kind of almost look back and you think, how did I do that? So if I take Rachel, for example, she died and then I was on the air 15 minutes later broadcasting. And somebody said to me, but you know what, Deborah, that's what you do as a broadcaster. You keep the conversation going. And so you do. But I think her death is now starting to hit me in terms of, I kind of look back at those couple of weeks and think, how did I do that? How did I write about it, talk about it, broadcast about it? I just don't know. But then it's also kind of how we have to acknowledge the fact that actually, you know what, sometimes you just want to curl up in a ball and have those really, really rough days. I don't know, how do you guys pull yourself, wait, if you're having a really bad day, what do you actually do about it?
Well, I mean, I definitely have not experienced five people that I know and love dying. Like, that's a big deal. I think what I'm learning as I get older, though, is to feel the emotion.
Yeah.
And really almost go through it. But the grief that you're experiencing is a whole nother level, Deborah. I don't know anybody who's experienced that amount of grief. And, you know, I know that people talk a lot about, oh, well, there's five stages of grief, but I'm sure that's not a linear journey.
No, it's not. I found this out. So I recorded with this lady called Shelley, who is basically the CEO of a charity called The Grief Encounter. And we asked her the question, and she's written books about grief. And we were sitting around, and I recorded with Rachel's husband, and we're all there kind of wanting the answer in terms of, what does grief look like? And, you know, you're kind of thinking, oh, maybe I've got to stage two. Maybe I'm just angry, or maybe I'm in whatever it might be. And she threw everything up in the air. She said, no, it's not really a process like that. And she said, you know what, you have to kind of stop it. Looking at it as something that you are going to park one day and leave behind you. And I came away thinking, well, what does she mean by that? Does that mean I've just got to deal with it for the rest of my life? But I think it's just, you learn that actually it is going to affect you, and you just become a little bit stronger and you kind of take it with you. But you learn how to kind of acknowledge that and say, you know what, that's a really tragic thing that's happened.
Can I ask how this feels for you? Because I think it's one thing when somebody close to us dies.
Yeah.
It's another thing when you are living with stage four bowel cancer and somebody close to you dies of cancer.
Yeah, you project your future onto it. So that's what's throwing me. So I'm already grieving for my own life, even though nobody's told me that I have to. And I'm sitting here with heels on and lipstick on and whatever.
Looking amazing.
Thank you. It's a big mask, I have to say. But yeah, I think that's exactly what happens. I think you don't just grieve for their life. You grieve for kind of, well, hang on a moment, I'm a ticking time bomb and you think I'm going to be next. So what I've taken from this kind of slightly rough period of my life, I have to be honest with you, in that I'm not saying it's all rough, you know, I've done some brilliant things, but I think it's acknowledging that actually, you know what, I don't know anyone who would be handling the stuff that I'm going through in a good way. And what I'm finding is that the more that I'm saying to people, you know what, I'm finding it quite tough at the moment, the more people are like, actually, yeah, okay, that's okay, now we can help you, rather than me like trying to run away from it.
Yeah, because you say dealing with it in a good way, and my immediate thought was, if you were dealing it in a way where you were all like, everything's fine,
I'm fine,
I would be like, that's not a healthy way to deal with what is essentially, what you're going through is traumatic.
Yeah, but don't you find that like when you're in the midst of it, sometimes you're like, I'm fine, I'm absolutely fine. And you put this like smile on and you put lipstick on, whatever it is. And then you sometimes like, you carry on running and then you hit a brick wall. And I did that, and I hit a brick wall. And then I just thought, I don't know, I just cried. I didn't really know where to start. I think I just had to start piecing myself back together. I think I'm just about to start piecing myself back together.
Have you got to a place now where you can feel when you have to take a time out, when you have to say, no, I can't do this thing, I have to say no to this?
Yeah, but I haven't started saying no.
That's
the next step. I think acknowledging that you sometimes need to say, well, that I did a little bit too much there. Because the way that I've learned, that the way that I deal with stuff is I keep myself busy, because I kind of figure that if I can keep myself busy living, I don't have to think about anything else. And then I sometimes realise that I've totally and utterly overcommitted to life just generally. So that is my next plan of action. That's going
to
be my new year
learning how to say no.
Do you feel like you are getting better? You know, you've been living with this stage four diagnosis and you've constantly been in this state of I guess none of us know, but like you say, you do have a ticking time bomb, but you're living constantly with this ticking time bomb. Do you feel like you are able to work with that in a better way than you could have done, say, 6 months ago? Or do you feel like it's just this never-ending battle that you've got to keep working with?
It is a never-ending battle. I think it comes in waves, though. So I'm due for more scans, which sends anyone into a, like a tiz, and you just don't know what's around the corner. But I think it's kind of acknowledging that it's not going to be plain sailing. And I think for me also, it's kind of like what I'm learning is that I'm now, I was diagnosed nearly 2 years ago, and I'm kind of thinking, well, I'm still here. I'm not even supposed to be sitting here. Do you know what I mean? So I kind of think, well, okay, let's just park that for a little bit and kind of get busy with all the projects that I'm kind of doing. So you just kind of think, oh, I'm going to get my teeth into living for the moment. But that is hard. I'm not saying it's easy. It is quite hard. But yeah, keep myself busy.
And the other thing that must be strange is that in the midst of all these terrible things happening, you've also had some great things happen.
Yeah, I know, some like really crazy stuff. So like really my whole life has changed. Like when I think about like career changing, like I am an absolute career changer. I was a deputy head teacher in a secondary school, and now, you know, when you fill out forms and you think, oh, what should
yeah,
I do?
Yeah, what do you put now?
What do I put? Now I actually put author, writer, yeah, and broadcaster, because I think I can call myself that. So I wrote a book. Yay.
Yeah, you've got it here. I've read it, actually. Well, I got the audio book to listen to.
Did you?
So it's lovely to hear your voice. And also, I remember all your Insta stories where you were just like, oh my goodness, I've got it wrong. Oh, I'm in this small little room recording my audio book.
So I wrote a book. It's I can't actually say the title on air, can I?
We're going to say it's called FU Cancer, and it's How to Face the Big C, Live Your Life and Still Be Yourself.
It's got a lot of asterisks, hasn't it?
Yes. Yeah,
against it. So yes. Okay. Yeah. But I basically wrote it whilst I was undergoing my initial treatment, because I kind of thought, well, hang on a moment, if I was newly diagnosed, what would I want people to kind of say to me? And not from a medical perspective.
So were you writing it as almost like a blog then, and it's now become a book, or are these personal writings?
No, I was writing it as a kind of like almost a kind of how to deal with the mental side of things, yeah, because you're handheld through everything else. So I wanted to look at the kind of, you know, when you're at 3 o'clock in the morning and you're sitting there and your mind is going absolutely bonkers, what should you be saying to myself? The problem is I read it back and I was thinking, oh, that's really good advice, Deborah. Maybe I should start taking it.
It's always easy, isn't
I shouldn't say that, should I?
But, no, you know, it's always easier to give advice than to take your own,
is,
inevitably.
And I was thinking, actually, if I followed this book, it would really help me.
But you know, it's very interesting, because there are lots of books out there about cancer, but not about that mindset. And it's, I definitely mindset, you know, I like, you know, you've come on tonight and bravely said, you know, how you are struggling at the minute, but yeah, overall I think your mindset is absolutely incredible and inspirational. And I know you say sometimes, aww, you're doing too much, but you really do. Like, I don't know how you've been feeling today, but you've got up, you've put makeup on, you're here, you're chatting.
Oh, thank you.
And like, you know, you're pushing through. And there was lots in this book that I took away in terms of how I'm going to support somebody that I know who's going to have to go through chemo in the new year.
Okay.
And my main concern has been about their psychological welfare, yeah, because I feel it's one thing to go through it physically, but I feel like your mind is all
your
part of that healing,
so
process.
Powerful. And it's, you know what, there's loads of research, but there's no evidence that mindset changes your prognosis. But there's absolutely evidence that says it changes your anxiety, your depression, the way you can just kind of handle the situation. And exercise does that as well, actually. So I'm a massive advocate for kind of getting up, putting your running shoes on. Although in order to prove living, I fractured my ankle running a half marathon to prove I could live with, yeah, cancer, which I thought was hilarious. But I think it is mindset. Like, I used to study when I was a deputy head, I did a lot about growth mindset in schools. And I just thought, how can you apply that to any, you know, illness, any other situation? And really, it just forces you to get up and say, you know, kind of go, right, come on then. I've just got it.
Is that also how you got through your chemo? Because I remember the first time you were a guest on our show, which was probably a year ago.
At least, yeah.
And you had literally been through 21 rounds of chemo, yeah, at that time. And to me, I don't know how you would get through 21 rounds of chemo without that mindset.
Yeah,
of,
you have to physically. I had to physically talk myself into getting my bum to the door. That's half the battle. Yeah. Half the battle is turning up.
Especially when you know you're putting yourself through that anticipation of feeling unwell for a few days.
Yeah, and, it's really hard. And it's like with any challenge, isn't it? You know, when it's, I don't know, it could be anything from the admin that you don't want to do to whatever it is you do have to talk yourself into it. And you can talk yourself out of it. I had a couple of incidences where I talked myself out of it and I had to send myself away for a couple of days. Give myself a talking to and then sit myself back in the chair and have the chemo. But you do, you have to kind of go through that process. And I think acknowledge that it's not easy and that then just go, duh. But yeah, it's, but I kind of, yeah, so I would say the last couple of months, even though it's been a bit of a roller coaster, I have done some quite fun stuff. It's amazing what you can do when you just say yes to everything. I think sometimes, like, you know, you get these moments where you're blindsided and it's quite easy to then go into a cave and say no to everything, and you kind of pull the you know, batten the hatch down. And actually I almost did the opposite. I kind of went, no, screw this, I'm gonna say yes to everything. And I was doing a speech the other day and somebody said, and I think throughout the speech I kept on saying, well, I had cancer, so I said yes to this, and I had cancer, so I said, and it's amazing where you can end up when you say yes to things.
What's the most random thing you've said yes to?
Oh, that's a good question. Oh, it's not very interesting. It's probably just like going to some dodgy bar and
said yes at 2 a.m. when you really should be going home. One of those.
No, I would say the kind of things that I said yes to, which were really big kind of, well, not challenges, but punts for me, was somebody saying, I have no background in writing. Somebody saying, do you want to write a book? So I said yes. Somebody saying, do you want to write a column? So I said yes. Do you want to do a podcast? So I said yes. But I could have just said, oh no.
I was going to say, do you feel that the cancer has made you more fearless in that respect?
Yeah.
Because there are a lot of people who'd be like, well, I can't write a book. Why am I going to write a book? And you're just like, do you know what? I'll write a book. I'll do a podcast.
Exactly.
I'm like, so do you feel like you know, you're going through a lot of stress and a lot of fear with the cancer, but has it made everything else actually like, do you know what? I'm just whatever.
Well, I just think, what's the worst that's going to happen?
Yeah.
And actually, I'm probably staring at the worst case scenario, right? Yeah. So I'm staring at the other worst case scenario. So if I can park that, if I try and write a book and it fails, but actually it did really well.
Yeah.
So you just have to kind of go.
What's the response been like from the book?
It's been amazing. The thing that I found amazing about it is people sending me pictures of them in hospital reading the book attached to a chemo pump or whatever it might be. And I just thought, oh, that's why I wrote it.
Do you know what? I've been listening to your podcast and the book, and I found it really brilliant in terms of just demystifying what is a very, very tough time. And you see, I don't know, you see a lot of awfulness around it, but you guys made it really, like, really real, but in a sort of, you just took away the sort of scariness around it and made it much more like, this is something, it's going to happen, much more matter of fact. What I have found is, though, a couple of people that I know, this person who's close to me who has cancer, they can't read it, they can't
they're too scared.
And I keep saying to them, please read it, please listen, because actually they are going to take out that fear, because they're going to tell you, the fear is always the unknown.
It's the unknown. Do you know, I've had a lot of people will say that. So we put out a episode yesterday with Steve Bland, Rachel's husband, and a lot of people have said to me, I can't listen to it at the moment because it's just too much of a hard listen. But I recorded that the day after a very good friend of mine died, not from cancer, from cystic fibrosis. And I was literally in tears thinking, I don't want to go to Manchester. I don't want to go and record. You know, when you actually have to kind of drag yourself into a situation because you think it's going to be really, really hard. And you know what? I recorded and I came out and I had talked about grief and I felt so much better. Yeah. But Rach made us record about death.
I listened to that one. It was powerful.
It was really powerful.
But you know what? It was amazing because you were all talking about, you know, the fear of dying.
Yeah.
You know, we all have a fear of dying. And when you've got a loved one who's going to go through treatment and you wonder what outcomes that might be, and you had the nurse on talking about, and it just made it go, oh, actually.
But I admitted I wasn't comfortable.
Yeah.
I sat there saying, guys, like, literally, I was sweating. Like, doing that. I was literally like, oh, I feel really uncomfortable. But it goes back to exactly what you were saying. It like, as soon as you then face up to it and you say, you know what, I'm going to approach it, it becomes a bit easier.
Yeah.
Big thank you to the fabulous Deborah James, aka Bal Babe. Go check her out.
when it comes to your finances, you think you've done it all. You've saved, you've researched, and you've invested all that you can. Now it's time to take those investments to the next level by using the brand behind every great investor, Yahoo Finance. As America's number one finance destination, Yahoo Finance has everything you need, whether you're a seasoned trader or just dipping your toes into the market. Join the millions of investors who trust Yahoo Finance to guide them on their financial journey. For comprehensive financial news and analysis, visit yahoofinance.com, the number one financial destination, yahoofinance.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Since 2013, Bombas has donated over 100 million socks, underwear, and T-shirts to those facing homelessness. If we counted those on air, this ad would last over 1,157 days. But if we counted the time it takes to make a donation possible, it would take just a few clicks. Because every time you make a purchase, Bombas donates an item to someone who needs it.
Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
Badass Women's Hour XL on Talk Radio.
She'll get you talking.
Now we are talking to Titi Dawudu, looking at women of the future and particularly women in theatre and women of colour in theatre. Titi, you have written an incredible book that I was flicking through earlier called Hear Me Now, which is audition monologues for actors of colour. Why do you think that needed to be written?
Well, for me, it's because of actors that I was working with over quite a long time just felt like they didn't have really great audition materials to work with. So I was actually writing their audition monologues for them. And I thought, there's something in this. And Hear Me Now was born, really.
Tell us a little bit about you and how you kind of got into theatre and your background.
OK, so I didn't take actually a traditional route. I went to uni. And I went to Northampton. I did media and sociology. I thought I might want to be a serious journalist, maybe.
Great right turn on that, let me tell you.
I left university. I worked for GMTV. And I thought, I want to be a storyteller. I want to work in the arts. And when I was 15, my very first mentor was Lucy Neal, who co-founded Lyft. And she took me to see my very first play. And that was Othello. And it was at the National. And I put on a big puffy ball dress because I didn't know what you wore to the theatre. And you didn't need to wear that, but I wore that. And I remember, waiting for it to start. And I was like, I was quite a shy child. And then I saw a black man walk on stage and I was like, what? I didn't even know this existed. You know, I wasn't from a theatre going family. This was the first time I'd ever experienced it. So for me, it was like, wow. And that seed was planted. And that was like 22 years ago. And I've just been in theatre kind of thing ever since, doing something, whether it was working with young people and getting them into the arts. And now I work at Oval House as a learning art participation manager. And for me, it was that seed that was planted all those years ago, really.
Amazing. And for people who are not in the theatre and don't understand, what's important about an audition monologue? What is it and why does it matter which one you pick?
Well, I mean, some actors, depending on what they're going up for, they may already have that audition monologue because it could be a part of the script that they're learning. But then there's other types of auditions where you have to bring something with you. And so the actors that I have been working with over the years, and when I went to Central St. Martin's and I worked with some of the actors at spoke to some of the actors at Drama Centre, they just couldn't find really great pieces that they felt represented them, and so we just had conversations. I was working with another theatre company at the time, and it was like, actually, let's hear from the actors. Let it be more than just writers writing monologues. Let's hear from the actors. And what we did, we had workshops, and we asked the actors, if you could play any part, what would that be? And that's what became the monologue. So we actually asked them. So we've got like a first black man that goes to space. We've got an Aman that's on like on a dating thing. We've got an Indian girl who wants to be a country singer. And these are all the parts that actors want to play one day. Because a lot of actors who are like early career emerging actors, they're given like really stereotypical parts. Like if you're Asian, you might get the terrorist part. If you're a black guy, you might get the gang member, you know. And when you're early career, you just have to take those parts because you need the money, you need the experience. Yeah. So for me, it was about empowering them in the audition room, because most of the time when they're in the audition room, the casting director's white, the director's white, the producer's white, and already you're preparing for a part, let alone then thinking about how am I going to be perceived, you know, things like that. So for me, this Hear Me Now is a toolkit. It's just something to empower them, when they're in the audition room to kind of go for that part.
It sounds like what you've actually got is a book of what could be really amazing films, scripts, TV productions, stories.
Yeah. I actually haven't thought about it that way. Yeah, definitely. They're the start of something. Yeah, 100%. Because they're like, they're short, 3-4 minutes, whatever. You can use them in workshops too. But yeah, the stories and the characters can be developed, 100%.
Because we've had, in fact, we had somebody on the show a couple of weeks ago. And
is it the National Youth Theatre?
Yeah, National Youth Theatre. And we had the two lead actors in. And that's typically been, I don't remember what the story was, but it's typically
Queen Victoria and Prince Albert, and the two actors playing Victoria and Albert, and they had two young black actors. And we asked them about what was the response to that when you've got two characters that are real people that we traditionally think of, if we're thinking of them on film or on screen, we're thinking Judy Dench.
Good old Judy.
And they were just like, no, it's just a part. You're just learning the part, being part.
And I think, and we've had conversations as well about, movie directors that are doing like blind casting. Yeah. And then when this story came up, for me, it was, I was just like, actually, this is far more interesting because, we're talking about trying to do blind casting and getting different ethnic diversity into films, but actually you're not telling an authentic story. And like you say, just because you are a black actor, it doesn't mean that you're going to be stereotyped in these roles, and everybody's walking this life in a different path. So when you, some of those stories that you said, I was like, well, yeah, wouldn't it be amazing to see these told as to get the diversity that we need in theatre?
Because some of these monologues aren't even just culturally specific. I mean, you've got a boy who likes football and he likes Bake Off. He likes baking as well. Yeah. And again, for that young actor, it was like, that's just a great part for me that I would never get to play probably. So let me have fun in the audition room.
Do you think it's going to be... Actually, let me change this question. What has been the response from casting directors to this?
Well, yep, so far so good. So we had Hannah Miller, who's the casting director at Royal. She's the head of casting at Royal Shakespeare Company. So she's loved it. And when we had the launch at RADA, she was on the panel, and she loved it. So when we did the pilot for this, we actually used the National Youth Theatre, some of the young people there. And then on the panel, we had a few casting directors. And yeah, so everyone's loved it. Everyone's really loved it.
And what difference would you like to see? If we're sort of 10 years down the line and people have really taken this book and used it, what difference would you like it to have made?
Well, I want this to kind of spark something. I feel like I'm one person, and even though I partner with another theatre company, but I'm still one person. But I feel like if one person, it's that thing, if you can do something, start the conversation, make little change, then I'm hoping that in 10 years time we wouldn't be surprised if there's a black actor playing, Henry the Fearful. It's just like, okay, cool. It doesn't have to be an issue. It doesn't have to be talked about. When Beverly Knight played Emmeline Pankhurst at Sylvia at the Old Vic, she just got so much flack for it. But then for years, like, white people have been blackfacing and, all sorts. It's like, oh, come on, let it just be about the story, or let it just be like, we're taking a different take on this, but it has to be so political.
Yeah, I agree. Do you think this is going to empower, I guess, more actors of colour to start also creating their own stuff and taking these stories and being like, actually, this is a 3 or 4 minute monologue. It can be a production. Let's do it.
I hope so. I'm really all about empowerment, really. I'm just, as I said, I'm just one person. It's for me, it's about, what can we do? If we want change, what can we do together, collectively? And just thinking that this could be the start of something, I really hope that. To me, this is about a legacy as well. I'm really big on that. I'm really big on, what can I, I have a son and I'm thinking, what is the world? He's only 18 months old, but what will the world be like when he's 18, when he's finished uni or apprenticeship or whatever he wants to do, what's the world going to be like? So can I do something? I mean, I don't know if he's going to be an actor, but can I do something small that could spark something that could grow or whatever, you know?
Yeah, because I'm thinking as well that the impact of these stories when they're read in front of people who are involved in a production, and even that is going to have influence, isn't it? Because people are going to hear stories that they've never heard or seen before. So yeah, I think this book is going to be really, really,
because I think it's such a shame, because a lot of the time when you hear stories that are like, you know, culturally diverse, it's about struggle or pain, and it's like, yeah but what about love?
What about the
what about
the
friendship?
Day-to-day? Yeah.
I don't know, parenting. We, you know, that's hard too. I want to hear about that. So for me, it's actually ordinary stories. I mean, some of them, yeah, like, you know, the first black man in space. But again, that why can't you have that, you know? But some of these are just everyday stories about love and friendship and you know, things like that.
Beautiful. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Personally, can I just say, I also really agree with you that I think everyone should dress up for the theatre. I always do. And I'm always very sad when I see people there in jeans. That's just what I'm saying. Titi Doherty, thank you so much
thank
for coming
you.
In. The book is called Hear Me Now, Audition Monologues for Actors of Colour. It is definitely worth finding if that is you. It's a great book and just some beautiful stories in there.
Badass Women's Hour XL on Talk Radio.
She'll get you talking.
We are talking to Alex O'Neill about life as a boomerang child. Hi, Alex.
Hello, Harriet.
So tell us how old you are and what makes you a boomerang child.
I am 35 and I'm currently living back at home with my mum and dad, my husband who commutes between London and Belfast, where we are now, and my one-year-old son. So, yeah.
And how's that going?
You know, there are ups and downs, mainly, and I've been really surprised by this. I'm secretly really loving it. I mean, it's a pretty sweet setup. My mum does all my laundry. She irons my knickers, which is a revelation. My dad does all the cooking. So all those big things, all those stresses that I had in London, as well as sort of working as a freelance journalist, which is quite stressful, and trying to juggle new motherhood as well. I hated doing laundry. I hated having to try and cook every night. It was too much. So they've taken all those, you know, big kind of housework loads, those domestic loads off me, which has been great. And it's really nice having, you know, someone around to talk to in the evening when my husband's working, or just be there to help with the kid a bit, or, you know, watching
how,
all around.
I have to ask, how are your parents feeling about this? They thought you'd gone and you were out, and now you're back again with child.
I think they're used to, with child, exactly. I think they finally thought, you know, my sister's in Australia and I thought, right, we've got rid of both of them. So they weren't expecting this. However, it was mum's idea, because we're moving to France next year. We wanted to save. We just found sort of living in London, so now impossible to get any savings together. So mum said, look, why don't you come in for a couple of months? But I think she's ready. We're all having a great time, but I think it works because there's an expiration date. We know that we're moving out in February. I hope so anyway. So everyone's just making the most of it. But they do miss. I mean, they're fond of a drink and running around the garden naked. I'm not making that up. They've done that before. And I think they'd like to get back to that stage where they can be a bit more free and, yeah, have naked Fridays if they want to.
Have you reverted to a teenager? I feel like I always revert to a teenager from around all my family too long.
Oh, man, absolutely. So, yeah, I found myself just having silly strops or just get annoyed about things that I wouldn't be annoyed about. Normally, if mum's talking when I'm trying to watch a programme, I'm just, you know, a sigh and roll my eyes very dramatically. And and I almost slammed the door the other day. I just had to check myself. Like, get a grip. Seriously, you're a grown woman. But it's hard not to. And especially when everything's done for you. Like, mum keeps going on at me. Changed your sheets? Have you hoovered the floor? And, you know, I don't really kind of like her going into my room and checking if I'm keeping everything clean. So there are boundaries to be drawn. But, I think everybody kind of has to check themselves a bit when you're in this arrangement, because obviously it's not the ideal, and you've got to be respectful of, you know, it's their house, but at the same time they know that I'm a grown woman, I've got, you know, a kid. And I think that's the toughest bit when you have a baby, because you've got two sets of parents really
Alex,
involved.
What prompted your decision to move back in with your parents? How did it come about?
So we were in London for a decade, and we'd always talked about having a bit of change. We wanted to go to France, and it was just really hard to save. It's impossible. I mean, London is just so crazy. We did have a place there, and we just found that, you know, in the evenings we were too knackered to even plan for it. So, yeah, when mum suggested moving back, we could have some time to save. We could logistically start planning for a move, we thought it would be a bit of a good idea. And actually, it's been going well so far. I mean, we've saved a good bit and my head's a lot clearer. I've got a lot more time to myself and to get things organised and to go over to France and do recces and look at houses. So it has been worthwhile. But, if that means sacrificing your independence a bit, I guess it'll be worth it.
Do you think it's just a London thing? Is it... When we all kind of move to London at a young age, we have to accept that we're going to have to move out again. Or is it something that's affecting kind of young people all over the country where the money just isn't there to save to buy our own place?
I do think it's wider than that. I mean, I think everybody always focuses on London because it is crazy. I mean, even renting is impossible. But yeah, I mean, the figures do show that it is something that's UK-wide. And it is a shame. And I think it's not so bad for me, I'm a bit older and I know that we're leaving and, I have moved out and I have had my own place. But I think that there still is such a stigma attached to it, especially when you're, maybe in your mid-20s and you're really excited about, I'm going to leave university and get a cool job. And then to have to go back to your parents, it feels like, I guess, for a lot of people, a bit of a failure. And it's just not the case. It's tough. I don't really know what a lot of people can do, but just look at it. It's a stepping stone, and... If it's a couple of months or up to a year, if it helps you save and get to where you want to be. But,
I'm not doubting at all that you're finding it difficult to save London because it is really difficult. But I do keep seeing all these articles being written by people where they're like, I earn 40 grand and I live with my parents and I still have no free cash. Is it? I don't want to say that millennials are all spending their money on avocado on toast because, quite frankly, it's delicious and why shouldn't you? But...
Well, absolutely, yeah.
Do we just have a different attitude to spending than our parents' generation, maybe?
I think possibly, but at the same time, so you hear this a lot about, there are people saying that millennials do spend all their money in avocado and toast, but it's like the reality is they're not going to be anywhere near to affording to buy houses. That's the thing. It's not a reality for most millennials. So you could not buy avocado and toast every day for 10 years and you still wouldn't cobble together even a fraction of what you need for a deposit, not even in London. So... I guess the attitude is, well, why not? We need to sort of spend our money on something. We want to have a good life. So instead, we spend our money on experiences rather than those material possessions. So I guess it's just reevaluating what success looks like and changing that view of what it is to be successful. So I think millennials, it's a lot more about experience than bricks and mortar or having those traditional hallmarks of adulthood, which was buy a house, get married, have kids. So I think it's unfair to say that it's just that we can't save. Maybe we can't.
You're right. Just going back to what you're saying about stigma, because I was just thinking about, if I dated a guy and he said that he lived at home with his parents, I think I'd be really judgy about it.
Yeah, and I think that's it. I think it's tougher for guys. I definitely do. I mean, a lot of my friends have been... Yeah, they don't think it's strange, whereas a lot of my husband's friends have been a bit funny about it, or, God, that's really strange that you're moving back in. And I do think it's harder for guys, because maybe it's less sexy. I don't know. It seems unfair, but...
I think there's just a stereo... It's interesting, actually, because I always think about these stereotypes for, say, older women, but actually there is a stereotypical man that you... think is living at home. I think that's what I'm transferring on if somebody says that. But you're right, in this day and age it makes an awful lot of sense. And I also think that we've lost our whole sense of community, and actually living at home with your parents or close proximity, I think it's probably just a bit healthier for us regardless of the door slamming. But do you know what I mean? I just feel like that's probably we've lost that. We all want to live as like individual units. But I feel like we need to almost rethink accommodation, because now we've got lots of people living as individual units. And, we know that's not the healthiest way for society to live.
Exactly. And if you think about it, in many places in the rest of the world, a lot of people still live at home when there isn't that stigma attached. And I think it's just about uncoupling this idea that self-reliance and it doesn't necessarily mean that you don't need to get help or that you need to live on your own. So as long as I guess that you're... When you are living at home, you've got a purpose, maybe you're saving for something, you clean up after yourself and don't take them for granted, and, do your own laundry from time to time. It's fine, but if I thought this was going to be a long-term arrangement, I think I'd definitely go a bit crazy.
Yeah, but that's living with anybody, right?
Yeah,
I think long-term.
Exactly, yeah.
Alex, exactly. I have to ask you, you haven't just moved back by yourself, you've moved back with your husband. Has that been a bit weird? I mean, I'm basically asking, can you have sex in your parents' house?
Sex, yeah. No, I get any time that's kind of, he's going to kill me, any time that he's gone there, I just can't. I feel like I'm a teenager again. I'm just like, no, they might hear the bed creaking. Yeah, it's definitely put a dampener in things in that regard. So, which is another reason why we need to get out quickly.
I had to ask because I had a friend who did this with... when she and her partner were saving up and they moved back in with her parents, and her parents, even though they were married, literally moved them into separate rooms.
No, really?
No.
Yeah. And they sort of made this thing about, oh, it's because, you know, it's easier just to do it this way so that we still have the guest room free or whatever. I don't know what it was. But literally moved into separate rooms. And she said, he would try and corridor creep. And she was like, nope, sorry, this can't happen. You have to go back to your own room.
I would be locking that door. I couldn't. I feel like I'd be 17. The embarrassment, I just couldn't cope with it. And I know it's awful. I feel really bad. Actually, we've got a free house tonight, so maybe we should.
Take full advantage.
Make the most. Okay. Alex, finally, if somebody's listening to this and thinking, oh God, the only way I think I'm going to get any kind of savings together is moving back in with my parents, but I don't know if I can do it, what are some top tips?
Okay, create boundaries. Straight off the bat, so we all sat down and we had a chat and we sort of said, look, you know, especially when it came to William, our son, that this is how we want to raise him, and it'd be great if you could be supportive, but like not try and jump in. We have a separate, we're quite lucky in that mom and dad have space, so we do have a separate room that we can go into, so we're not on top of each other all the time. Yeah, it's just about being really clear up front and not letting things fester, and then if there are things that you're a bit annoyed about, clearing the air straight away. And yeah, I would say I am really bad in that I do fully let mom do all of my laundry and I love it. But I would
try. Would you do mine?
I'll send her
on. I love my knickers on. Yeah, that'd be amazing.
It really is amazing. Like, it feels so good.
The way you've talked about that.
And then it just sits in the drawer really neatly. I'm really going to miss it. I'll have to bring her over. But yeah, just have that conversation up front and I think have a date that you're going to move out, because if it feels like you're just, it would get pretty depressing if you thought you were just moving in without a goal. So yeah. If you know it's for a set amount of time, I've got a friend who's doing the same thing to save for a house. And she said that it worked fine because she knows that it's not for long. So yeah, if you just see it as a stepping stone, it can be a really good thing. And it is quite nice to sort of reconnect with your parents at this age because you appreciate them a lot more, I think.
Brilliant. Alex, thank you so much. Jenna's Alex O'Neill. If people want to follow your life adventures as a boomerang child, where can they find you?
Oh, the Times. The last piece of it was for the Times.
Brilliant. Thank you so much, Alex.
This has been the Badass Women's Hour podcast with me, Harriet Minter, Natalie Campbell and Emma Sexton. If you want to hear more from us, you can come follow us on social media at Badass Women's Hour, HR, or leave us a review and tell us how much you love us. We really need to feel the love. 5 stars should do it.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Hey, folks, I'm Mark Maron from the WTF Podcast, and this episode is brought to you by Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues, your ally to help tackle your allergy symptoms this season. I love the change of seasons, but nobody loves pollen and all those other things floating in the air that make you sneeze during this nice weather. Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues are hypoallergenic and allergist approved. So fight back against watery eyes and runny noses without worrying about irritating your skin. For this allergy season, grab Kleenex and face allergies head on.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.